The Moth is a place for true personal stories. It started in New York in 1997, but now we produce events all around the world. Audiences pack these intimate venues to hear stories from people they've never met before, and everyone leaves more connected. This episode has three stories. A boy is cast out of his family when he falls in love with funerals. Greg Wallach confronts an evangelical minister who wants to cure his cerebral palsy. And Amy Cohen, in this first story, needs to make a life or death decision. Amy told this story at a Moth called In Harm's Way, Stories About Danger. If you've never been to a Moth main stage, we introduce each storyteller by way of a question related to the night's theme. And the night Amy told her story, the question was, what is your irrational fear? She answered, I have so many irrational fears, I don't know where to begin. My fear is that I'm going to develop more irrational fears. She sounds very excited as she tells this story, but if you've met Amy, you know she always sounds like that. Here's Amy Cohen, live at the Moth.
So, I, as you now know, have always been a very fearful person. And as a child, I was, you know, the little kid who was gripping the stairs in the shallow end with the floaties and the kickboard. And as an adult, I was the person who would see a spot on her leg and think, oh my God, it's cancer, only to realize that it was newsprint from the Sunday Times. Yeah. And, I mean, I didn't think that I was strong enough for electrolysis, let alone the diagnosis I got when I was 38, when I found out that I had tested positive for the BRCA1 gene mutation, which is often called the breast cancer gene. And I got tested because the women in my family get breast cancer. My mom, my sister, my aunts, my grandmother, they all had it. And when you test positive, immediately, like within 5 seconds, you're assigned an oncologist. And they tell you just in case. And I said, you know, it felt like I was taking my first drink and signing up for rehab, you know, just in case. And, you know, the other weird thing about the test is that they call it a predictive, meaning that it's supposed to predict your chances of getting breast cancer throughout your life, which are said to be as high as 86%. But the weird thing for me was, you know, it's sort of hard to understand, is that I felt like I had it. I felt like I had it already, and no one was sort of giving me the legitimacy of saying, like, well, you have it already. So I felt like it was in me. So I was so anxious all the time. And one of the ways that it manifested was I was constantly giving myself breast exams. So I would be at dinner with friends, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, the tandoori chicken sounds really good. Yeah. And I was just a wreck. And, you know, I started to think, you really need to do something. And they tell you that you really only have two options. And the options are aggressive monitoring or a prophylactic mastectomy. And so I started thinking about that. But, you know, one of my big fears was, am I strong enough for this? You know, is it going to be okay, or am I going to explode like a cheap Chinese firecracker? I didn't know. So the strong one in my family has always been my sister, and never more so than in the year that she had breast cancer. And she's just one of those amazing people who, you know, like whipped up lemon tarts for her radiologist and smiled when blood was drawn. And the joke that we had, and it's so true, is that I said, I was hoping I could keep up with your exercise schedule when you were on chemo, but clearly I was wrong. And, you know, we always said that it was my mom's legacy of how to deal with breast cancer. You know, like, you're going to kick cancer's ass. And our mom had breast cancer the first time in 1972, when it was really considered a death sentence by many. And she had a really serious case, and it was a miracle she survived. And she was always so happy to be alive after that she got excited about the littlest things. And she would say, like, you know, Daddy and I went to Morocco, and we bought bananas from a toothless woman who was selling them with her feet. And it was like, woo, that's so exciting. And my mom actually had a very, very radical double mastectomy. And in the early 70s, they really gouged you out. So in profile, she really looked like a very delicate letter C. And, you know, I mean, we had no nudity in our household. And I think, you know, I always thought that that was part of it. And I used to joke that in our house, nudity was the state of existence between the shower and your towel. That's it. Because my mom was always really, really self-conscious, and I always thought it was because of her mastectomies. And so in addition to worrying about everything else, I really worried that I would hate my body as much as I always thought my mom hated hers. And so I called my sister and I said, you know, I'm thinking about getting this operation. And she said, what took you so long? And I thought that was particularly amazing because 7 years before my sister got breast cancer, she actually had a double mastectomy. And it's very, very rare that anyone gets it. And in fact, the doctor said, you know, we've only heard about this happening once in Europe. So, you know, we really felt like, oh my God, you know, is this really us? But it was. And, you know, my sister is so incredible that, you know, she's been just a model to us all. But she was one of the 3 to 7% who got it. And she was so encouraging of my getting it that I decided to schedule the operation and I could cancel at any time. That was what I kept on saying, cancel at any time. So I started telling people that I was going to have the operation. And, you know, the first thing I said is, I can't believe I have to get rid of my breasts, which I actually liked. I mean, I actually liked them, and they're very perky little A cups. Like, you know, people would like, you know, it was sort of like a, I don't know, like a demi-tasse cup. I mean, they're tiny. And I said, why do I have to be getting rid of those? Why can't I be getting a cellulitectomy? That would be good. But I think part of it, too, was that I wanted to sort of set the tone for how people were going to deal with me. I didn't want any pity. And, you know, one of the weird things, too, is that I was so anxious and so down. I mean, I was down for so many months when I found out that I was really afraid that if I didn't set the tone, people were going to bring me down. So I was very much like, this is how we're going to deal with it. You know, please just respect that. And they, you know, people were really good. But still, I really felt like, you know, I felt like someone might freak me out and, again, I might back out. But I didn't. I decided to have the operation at Memorial Sloan Kettering, where they really encourage you to take what's called a reconstruction seminar, which I said sounded like something from the Civil War. It sounds like a Civil War reenactment, doesn't it? Like a reconstruction seminar with Confederate flags and people in period costume. But in fact, it's a place where you find out about different methods of reconstruction, and there are really two kinds. One is implants, which we all know. Hello, Pamela Anderson. And the second is called tram flap surgery, where they take fat from usually your buttocks or your hips, and they make them into very natural-looking breasts, but usually you have to be a little bit heavier. And so my plastic surgeon said, no, unless you gain 50 pounds, you're really not a candidate. And I said, okay. So we went to this reconstruction seminar, and we saw lots of before and after photos, and I was in a room with like about 70 women, all of whom had breast cancer. And I didn't tell them why I was there. And I got to ask my question, which was, do people ever get implants and then decide to get the tram flap surgery? And they said, no, that never happens. And so afterwards, I was standing by the buffet table, and this woman came up to me, and she was wearing the kind of really kooky glasses that German avant-garde architects wear, you know, like Elton John, you know, and you know something bad is going to happen. And she said, I was talking to my husband. I heard your question about not having enough fat. And I said, look at her. She's got plenty of fat. Plenty. And I'd just gone through this terrible breakup where I'd gained 15 pounds, and I was eating a Danish at the time. So it really didn't help, and just the words were ringing, like, plenty of fat, plenty! And so I told that story so many times afterwards, and I think one of the reasons I told it is because the truth was so overwhelming for me, which was being in that room with all those women who had breast cancer, I felt lucky. I felt really lucky. And before that, I thought, like, who's put in the decision, you know, to remove a part of their body? What kind of decision is that? And then I thought, oh, my God, that's a decision that so many of those women wish they had had. And in that room, we'd seen so many scary before and after photos, and the after photos were just terrifying. And, you know, a lot of these women asked questions in trembling voices, as did I. And that was really the moment where I realized I was not going to turn back. I was absolutely, positively going to go forward with this operation because I was lucky. I really had an opportunity that they didn't have. So we get a little closer to my operation, and I was all misplaced anxiety. Like, I never said, like, I'm terrified about the operation. I would say, like, because my parents, you know, my whole family was trying to get me to date, and I was like, I am not going to try J-Date. You know, I was just hysterical. Like, that was my big thing. No! Because I'm having this operation, I don't have to. And then the other fear I had is, because I had never had surgery, was that I was going to OD on anesthesia. That was really fear. And that I was going to be the person on 2020 with the feeding tube, you know, like in the assisted living facility in New Jersey. Terrified. Like, I had a mosh pit in my chest. I was so anxious about that. And then the day of my surgery arrived, and I was calm. I was really at peace. It was pretty amazing, because now you guys know how crazy I am. And it was just incredible. And I got to the hospital, and I felt really proud of myself. And I remember also wearing my little gown and my little paper booties and shuffling into the operating room and feeling like Sean Penn in Deadpan Walking. And then I got into the operating room, and the nurse said, "Wow, you don't look 40. And I said, "Well, now I don't need any anesthesia." And that was it. And then the next day I woke up, and it was time to see my new breasts. And I thought, oh my God, is it going to be Pamela Anderson? Is it going to be Anderson Cooper? What am I expecting here? Yeah, who knows? And actually, I had skin expanders placed under my chest wall, and then they're filled with a little bit of saline. So I remember being in the hospital room, and you know, my gown was opened, and I slowly looked down, and I said, "Well, that's not traumatic. That's what they look like before," because they were tiny, which was perfect. So then they sort of put more saline in you as weeks go by. And at this point, I realized something incredibly important about myself, which is I love having bigger boobs. I love it. I love it. So it's the greatest thing that's ever happened. So my plastic surgeon said, you know, at some point we really need to decide what size you want to be. And I said, yeah, God's here. I said, vulgar. And he said, yeah. Because I also was like, the first time my postman remembered my name, I was like, I'm loving this. And he said, no, I'm serious, Amy. What size do you want to be? And I said, seriously, I want you to think like Playboy Mansion, Hollywood Wife, Carnival. And literally, as I was going under, I swear to God, this is true, I was saying like, as big as you can. Yeah. So that was, yeah. So then, you know, now, as we know, fake. So so what I never could, yeah, and actually my dad and I had this really cute moment at Starbucks one day, because he said, you know, because I was loving the boobs, and he said, you know, it's going to be a big year, Aim, big, big, big. And I said, delightful. We thought that was hilarious. It was our little bit of double mastectomy humor. So, you know, I think what I never could have realized in a million years is that I would consider this, I'm almost done, Maz, I swear, is that I would consider this to be really one of the best things that's ever happened to me. I mean, I really feel that it's changed my life, and I've begun to talk to a lot of women who have had the surgery or are having the surgery. And one of the times Memorial called me up and they said, "We don't even know how to ask you this." And I said, "I know what you're going to ask." And they said, "What?" And I said, "She wants to see them." And they said, "Yes, is that okay?" And I said, "Sure, whatever." So I met her in the locker room of Equinox, and I was like, "Woo!" Which I've done so many times since. And she looked at me, and I knew what she wanted to do. And I said, "You want to touch them?" And she said, "Yeah, can I?" And I said, "Sure." And so I went to second base with this stranger in my gym locker room, as I have done so many times since. Yes, trust me. And I think actually the most incredible thing I've realized through this whole thing is that, you know, I thought so much about my mom and my sister and I sharing the BRCA1 gene, but I've realized that we share another gene, which is the gene that tells you not to pity yourself and to deal with things in your own way, which in my case meant, you know, saying, "It only took me 40 years to become a blonde with big boobs. Great." And, you know, I so underestimated myself thinking that I would crack. And, you know, I saw these incredibly strong women deal with breast cancer, and I never realized until I had my own episode how much it had influenced me and how much stronger I was than I ever gave myself credit for. And now my sister is perfectly healthy, and she's in the room. And yay! I know, I love you. And my mom fought valiantly against the brain tumor that ultimately took her life. And, you know, I thought about how, you know, in addition to the BRCA1 gene mutation, we share another gene, and that's the resilience gene. And that's the gene that I hope will define me and everything I do for the rest of my life. And for that, I could not feel more fortunate. Yeah.
Amy Cohen is a screenwriter and the author of Late Bloomer's Revolution. She says she's still naturally blonde, even though she never had a blonde hair before she turned 40. She tells us, quote, "I'm still very proud of how I gained my rack. I talk with women all the time, and I've been felt up all over town," end quote. Coming up next, a self-professed funeral nerd remembers falling in love with burial ritual as a boy in Branchville, South Carolina.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse. What happens if your five-year-old son wants to play funerals all the time? Harlem funeral director Isaiah Owens was that little boy, and he tells this next story. Here's Isaiah live at the Moth.
Good evening. I am a funeral director. I know grief, and I know how to comfort people. When I was growing up in my hometown in Branchville, South Carolina, we were fed fried chicken, collard greens, cornbread, and funerals. At a funeral, there was a hearse. The hearse brought your body to the church and took you to the cemetery. That same hearse would take you to the hospital if you were sick. So the funeral homes acted as a funeral home and an ambulance service. When you was going to the funeral, they tolled the bells as the family approached the church. Once inside the church, they fed us that life, no matter how long you live, is just like a vapor. It appears for a moment and then it disappears. And then they fed us that we are like grass, which groweth up in the morning and flourishes and groweth up. And then in the evening, we are cut down and withered, and we fly away. At the age of 5 years old, I started burying things. After my grandmother, Mama Alice, died, I went and I buried a matchstick. I realize now what was happening is I went to Mama's funeral and I saw them put her in the ground and they covered her up and they made a nice mound of dirt and they put beautiful flowers on her. So then playing in the yard after the funeral, I went and I dug me a little hole and I put a matchstick in it, covered it up, and I put some flowers on it, and that was my first funeral. As I grew up, I continued to be attracted to burying things. I buried everything that died on the farm. I grew up on a cotton farm, so all of the animals, the chickens, or whatever died, I gave them a funeral, which caused me to be rejected by my family, isolated, and I was an outcast, and they thought that I was a little funeral nerd. However, I had one friend. That was Aunt Genia. Aunt Genia was born in 1882, and she was 68 years old when I was born. So I played funerals, and Aunt Genia would play funerals with me. Aunt Genia was the first African queen that I know. When we were growing up, Virginia could sit a big pan on top of her head and walk from my mother's house to her house with her hands by her side. The pan would be full of butter beans or whatever it was. She never had to hold it with her hand. Virginia had a vocabulary like Esther on Sanford and Sons. She made up her words as she went. She would call you a fish-eyed fool, or she would call you an old hag. But then after she hurt your feelings, she would always call you in the room and give you some candy or some chewing gum or even a nickel. So Virginia and I had this little love affair going on, and Virginia attended at least 10 of my little funerals. She thought that I was absolutely normal. And I remember one funeral, we had a toy wagon that had torn up. I wanted to dig a grave to do a funeral for it. So I got Virginia, and we went down in the woods, in the field, and I performed the funeral for the red wagon top. And Virginia was the family. She just thought that I was it. And I loved her very much. When I was 14, Virginia passed away, and I was devastated. Now it's time to go to Virginia's funeral. That day was a day that I felt that I had no reason to live. So as we left Virginia's house, they started ringing the bell. And the bell was so bitter and so hard to me. And I just kind of looked out of the window of the car, and I cried. The more the bell rang, the more I cried. And I just kept saying to myself, no more Virginia, no more Virginia. However, after the funeral, I picked myself up, and 5 years later, I graduated from American Academy McAllister Institute of Funeral Service, and I got a diploma in funeral service. And it was one of the best days of my life, because now I was on my journey to become the funeral director that I wanted to become, and I was just 18 years old when I graduated. However, it being such a wonderful day for me, it was a very sad day because none of my family members came to my graduation. After that, I got my license, and I buried my first customer, Mr. Rufus Felton, in 1971 from the church that I attended. After that, my business mushroomed. Now, Virginia's gone. My sister Maxine has taken Virginia's place. So Maxine and I were like twins. And she loved me, and I loved her. My family never referred people to me for a funeral, but when Maxine got her job and started teaching school, whenever someone passed away, she would always refer them to me. And Maxine wound up living with me for some years until I got her an apartment. However, Maxine came down with systemic lupus. My mother was here to help take care of Maxine when she was in the hospital. And the last time she was here, she called me aside and said, listen, I know that Maxine is not going to make it, and I want you to do Maxine's funeral. And I was honored that my mother would ask me to do Maxine's funeral, because I know that my family never used my services. Well, Maxine died, and we took her home to Branchville for her funeral and her burial. And that Saturday night, after her viewing and her wake at my funeral home, my brother Anthony and Lynn and myself, I was locking up the funeral home, and Anthony said to me, we can't leave Maxine here tonight by herself. And my brother Lynn and I agreed. So we went and got in the funeral home on the floor by Maxine's open casket, and we stayed the night with her. The next day, Maxine's 35th birthday, was her funeral. And on my way to the church, all of a sudden, I heard, bang! That was the church bells. And the bell that they sounded when Eugenia died was so harsh and terrible. But this time, I listened to the bell. And the bell went from being such a harsh sound to being a very sweet hum at the end of the sound. When I realized that this is a family reunion, I was hugging my mother, my father, my brother Anthony, Miss Jane, and genius daughter-in-law, Cousin Lizzie, Miss Harverell, my high school principal, Mr. Joseph Jackson, Sister Ophelia Euston, the wife of the pastor that baptized me and Maxine. My battery was charged up, and there was love. At the end of the day, I realized that I had been comforting all of these people for all of these years, and now not only my family, but the community has come to comfort me. At the end of the day, I realized then that there was love and that the spirits of those people who are gone on before, along with the spirits of the people that are alive, makes me strong, and it restores my soul, and it restores us.
That was Isaiah Owens. We found Isaiah when we partnered with the PBS documentary series POV for their 25th anniversary. He's the subject of a film called Homecomings, and he believes when you die, you go home. The awning of the Isaiah Owens funeral home on Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem reads, "Where beauty softens your grief." I sat with Isaiah in the wooden pews of his funeral chapel every day for a week to work with him on his story. He estimates that he's led over 14,000 funerals from 1968 to the time he told this story. And I asked him if there's any one in particular that stands out.
Martha Webb had come. She lived down the street, and she came to me for her mother's funeral. And she had no family except her mother had a cousin in Philadelphia that was like 90-something years old that came over for Martha Webb's mother's funeral with another cousin. And, I said to her, you know, you don't have a lot of family left, so you need to kind of sit down with me and or somebody and make some plans for what happens to you. And she never did it. And then one Saturday, not long after, the phone rang and it was like, "Mr. Owens." And I was like, "Yeah, this is Blanche. Martha Webb done died in the street." And I was like, wow. So anyway, she stayed in the morgue for over a month. Nobody claimed the body. And finally, I claimed it, and I gave her a funeral, and I gave her a burial. She wound up making the cover of the Traveler's book. She was beautiful, but the little connection that we had is that I had about 50 dresses that I had to select from for Martha Webb to be dressed in for her funeral, and I kept looking at all of these colors of dresses, and this green dress, every time I picked these other dresses, this green dress would say, "Psst, come back and get me," and I was like, so after haggling for a long time, I just went and got the green dress, and I put it on her. And when the friends came up for the funeral, they brought some pictures of Martha Webb, and there was a picture of her in almost the identical green dress at some party, where one of these Harlem parties where the cigarette smoke is thick and the glasses is all around with the liquor in it. It was amazing to me that for some reason, that dress had to be the dress.
A few years ago, Isaiah recorded a gospel CD.
I recorded it because I wanted to remember what I experienced as a child growing up at Mack Branch Church, where I started my funerals at. And I recorded the songs, and I sung them like they sung them back then. The only thing that's different is now the songs have music to it, but when we were growing up, the songs didn't have music. The only music was the padding of people's feet, that kept the music and the clapping of the hands. But my favorite song on the CD that I kind of rearranged a little bit from how we sung it is If It Wasn't For The Lord, Tell Me What Would I Do. And I got in my prearrangements that when I do pass away, I want them to play that song after my eulogy before the people leave the church. I pretty much have all the plans for my funeral. I want to be able to get the caisson like the presidents have, with the six white horses that you've seen in Arlington National, and a procession probably of funeral directors, and a procession of families of people that I buried that would want to go with me to the funeral, and lots and lots and lots of flowers, and a sarcophagus casket. It's called the Pharaoh sarcophagus. It's probably one of the most expensive caskets. It is the most probably expensive casket you can get. And I want the inside line with chinchilla. And I want to really have a nice procession from Lenox Avenue to Riverside Church, which might be the main event going over there and letting people say, I guess, goodbye to me, or so long. Yeah.
For more information on The Travelers, the book of 30 reconstructions of Isaiah's subjects and friends, and to see photos of Isaiah through the years, go to themoth.org. While you're there, you can share any of the stories you're hearing in this hour with your friends and family. You can also listen or share Moth stories through our app, which is now available for iOS or Android. Next up, a man with cerebral palsy goes on a wild ride after a gay Elvis impersonator breaks his friend's heart.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is about the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel that was brokered by President Carter at Camp David. Wright is also the author of The Looming Tower, about the history of Al-Qaeda, and Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from the Information Trust Institute at the University of Illinois, celebrating 10 years of creating more secure, reliable, and resilient medical systems, power grid, internet, and more. More information is available at iti.illinois.edu.
was that federal marshals were all over the place.
That march from Selma to Montgomery in 1965 in the southern state of Alabama was the last of three. Civil rights protesters calling for equal voting rights had been attacked by police in earlier attempts. As the world watched, the protesters, this time under the protection of federal troops, finally achieved their goal, walking around the clock for 3 days to reach Montgomery. It was the big breakthrough. The Voting Rights Act was passed later that year.
In the song itself, it says, "I wish I could get rid of the chains binding me." Are those emotional and mental chains as well, do you think, for Nina?
Absolutely. I think that we know that she struggled with manic depression all her life. And I really do think most of her life. It got worse, you know, as she went into middle age. But then there was, you know, new spectrums of medication were really very helpful.
Nina Simone felt racism and discrimination in the U.S.
And you're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580. We have a program impairment with the Moth Radio Hour. We'll continue with the BBC World Service until just before 11 o'clock this morning.
Like a bird in the sky, don't leave me.
Don't leave me.
How sweet it would be to find that.
She's letting people, allowing people to hear her talking to herself.
To the sun.
Ugh, I miss her.
For Alvin Shachtman, her performance, filmed at the time, was a hymn to anger and mental pain.
Wish I could break all things that bind us apart.
There. There's that anger.
And what it means to be me. You'd see. You'd agree.
Because
if we ain't, we're murderous.
Because if we ain't, we're murderous.
I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. I could find that I could fly. Soar to the sun. Look down and see. It's moving now.
Of course, you can't talk about Nina Simone and the song I Wish without thinking of some of the great jazz venues in New York where she performed. I'm in Birdland off 44th Street, and there's the glowing stage, and under the soft spotlights, that's where Nina performed in the 60s. And I've come to meet Salamisha Tillett, Professor of English and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, who's writing a book on Nina Simone.
I think the song represents that kind of conundrum or that gap between the yearning for freedom and the yearning for belonging and the reality that racism is alive and well in certain corners of the United States. It's such a tender expression of what it means to be an American citizen at a time when there's a hopefulness on the horizon that maybe this freedom that we've been fighting for can be gained. But at the same time, it also speaks to the long journey that African Americans have had in the United States up until that point to become full citizens.
It's been updated in a sense by John Legend, who's a young singer becoming a big star. He covered it in an album where he was looking and exploring quite a few of these old songs and representing them to a modern young American audience. And you wrote the sleeve notes for the album. Why did he include this song on his album?
I think for John Legend, Nina Simone is a figure, like many of our generation, who is someone that we kind of aspire to be. For him, and also for Questlove, when they came up with the concept for this album, Wake Up, they really were trying to capture some of the optimism and the political action that they saw young people having in the 2008 elections. And they felt like The album comes out in 2010, and I feel like they felt like that optimism and that activism was on the wane. And so how can you kind of capture that?
And, of course, John Legend, as a singer, came from the gospel tradition. That's really where he was trained, where he began to sing. And the way he sings it is very much in that tradition.
So he's actually blending both Billy Taylor and Nina Simone's version in his song in order to both resonate with that tradition that he grew up with and also speak to the moment that we're in now.
I wish I could give all longing to give, and I wish I could like I'm longing to live, and I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue, I'd be starting new.
John Legend's version of I Wish I Knew, recorded in 2010. But was he right? Does this song work as a rallying cry for contemporary Americans? At the New York Jazz Workshop, just off Times Square in Manhattan, jazz vocal students and teachers Iris, Alexa, Faye, Elizabeth and Yvonne, a typical mix of New Yorkers, have come together to work on I Wish I Knew for the evening and do what they love best, singing.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
I have a granddaughter who will be 14 this month, and I think this song, even though it was written a while ago, is still very important now, because with my granddaughter as a young black girl, she still sees images that do not look like her, and she tries to live up to those images. So the concept of good hair, bad hair, and all that other stuff, that stuff is so ingrained into this society that although there have been freedoms won and steps have been made, in a lot of ways, we're still right where we were at when this song was created.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give.
Part of the song that really resonates with me is the line, well, I wish I could be like a bird up in the sky. How sweet it would be if I found that I could fly. So the singing, I think, is sort of this idea that that's freeing. The whole idea that once you're actually singing, you are free. I guess the singing is sort of like a glimpse into what's possible, maybe. Yeah.
And I wish I could give all I'm longing to get.
It's still here. Yeah, slavery was abolished, but I feel like it just changed forms, and certain things are still used against people to keep us oppressed, like the ghettos and the drugs and the guns and police brutality, and the system feels like it's against you. So this song, it still reaches out to the black community. It's more intense, I feel like, the feeling of the song now. And like 100 years from now, it'll probably still be the same thing.
I would know how it feels.
Yes, I
would know how it feels.
We're not fighting anymore for what we believe in. Because if you just go back to the 60s and you go back to all those protests against the war, I mean, why are people not in the streets now when your government is spying on you?
Oppression has like become more invisible and feels more natural, and those in power have become more clever at hiding inequality and by making things like more complicated and complex.
To be free.
The song is actually most powerful, looking back at it now, 50 years later, insofar as it reminds us of this rich, you know, multi-hundred-year-old legacy of a black everyday musical practice that is both realistic, full of pain, full of possibility, and in a sense creates its own hopeful disposition.
Tricia Rose is professor of Africana Studies at Brown University, Rhode Island. Does she think the optimism of Billy Taylor's composition can still be found in contemporary American society?
As many philosophers have argued, you know, freedom is partly a state of mind, right? There are many people who have managed to stay both healthy and to stay hopeful under conditions that make no sense to produce health and hope. And yet, we are able as human beings to do it. Part of it is very much what is the story we have available that we can tell about ourselves that becomes, that creates resilience. It doesn't deny the suffering, it doesn't deny the chains, you know, in this case, but it says, I'm going to figure out how to be whole despite these conditions. Not going to be in denial, but I'm going to be whole despite it. That is really a technique of not just survival, but of transcendence that I think African-American culture has been genius at producing.
Is there anything like that now in American music that has the same effect?
Well, I mean, I think if you go to churches and spoken word events where people are in their own institutions, unselfconsciously representing and speaking about themselves, yes, you see that all the time. I mean, first of all, many spirituals and gospel songs still populate everyday black life in a profound way. Ironically, although people speak to the civil rights movement as being this really wonderful, positive moment, I think American society is really fascinated with and strangely obsessed with black rage and black unionism. And so it markets black death much more profoundly than it markets the opportunities and freedoms and love ethic of black culture.
Your own poem right after this song. Cool?
It is a song of its time, but it still provides inspiration today. In downtown New York at the New York and Poetry Cafe, Mahogany Brown, the host for the night's National Poetry Competition, is on stage.
And it begins with a quote, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I work at alternative prison programs. I work at alternative high schools where it's, you know, the school pipeline to prison. And this is the poem that came from being me and being inspired by Nina Simone. Today, I am a black woman in America, and I am singing a melody written lullaby. I am a black woman in a hopeless state, country, space. I will apply for financial aid and food stamps with the same mouth I spit poems from. I will ask the angels of a creative God to lessen the blows, and I will beg for forgiveness when I curse the rising sun, because today I am a black woman in a body of coal. I am always a patch of smolder dancing, and no one knows my name. I am a nameless fury. I am a blues scratch from the throat of Miss Nina. I am always angry, always alive. I am always a bumble hive of hello. Today I am a woman, a brown and black and brew woman, dreaming of a freedom song that will ring endlessly. Today I am a mother, and the world is burning like a southern lawn, or a young girl's bra, or a black man's hood, or a church with four girls that look just like me. On days like today, I forget how to flee from such a flamboyant backdraft. I am too in-